Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Welcome to the Market Musings podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. And today we're very happy to welcome our first private investor onto the podcast. We've put a few shout outs out there for private investors to come on because we've had a lot of company directors, but we would like to speak to some private investors as well. Now, this was kind of an easy win, really, because this particular guest is a close relation of mine, being my dad. His name's Ian, and he runs two long-established and successful businesses, and also has a history in private investing as well. So hello, welcome, Ian. Hello.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good, no problem. Yeah. So obviously I know about what you do, but for the benefit of Kenny and the listeners, maybe if you want to start just talking about the two businesses and sort of a synopsis of them both would be good, I think.
Yeah, okay. So they are very different. One's engineering, advanced engineering, robotics, and mainly in the food and beverage industry. The other one's a service industry. It's about people and business development. So you could say it's about training and it's about commercial awareness, really. It was the training business we started first in 1986. And really, there were two of us working for a big multinational. And we thought to ourselves, well, there might be another way of doing this. The plan was to play golf two or three times a week and do a bit of work for two or three days. That was the plan. We used to play golf twice a week when we worked for the multinational. I played golf twice since 1986. So sometimes the plans don't come into reality. But, you know, that's life. But the business today has three wholly owned offices, one in York, where we have a dozen people who are on the payroll, plus we employ about four or five freelancers in the UK. We have a business in Madrid, which we opened in with fantastic timing, obviously gifted when it comes to this sort of thing. We opened it in 2006. We thought what a great job we were doing until the economic crisis hit. But we have two full-time employees down in Madrid. And we also have an office in Russia, the Russian Federation, with two full-time employees there. And then at any one time, we might employ, you know, up to 20 freelancers, mainly across Europe. But 80% of our income comes from overseas earnings. So I'm more interested in the sort of global situation than I would be in terms of the domestic situation. And the clients are all blue chip. We go for market leading clients in very, very established sectors. So, for example, it's agricultural machinery, it's construction equipment, it's commercial vehicles like trucks and buses. They form 90% of our client base. So they're blue chips. They pay their bills. But of course, they're also open to the vagaries of the economy. So that's the the training business, which over the years that we've developed that. So there's now a multimedia division. There's an outside learning division, outward bound training, you might call it. There's some consultancy work around health checks and things like that. And yeah, it was, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit is alive in many people. You don't sleep for a while when you start your own business. You know, the paycheck might not be there. It's difficult. You have to put your house on the line. You have to convince, you know, your better half maybe to sign a bank guarantee that says that your house will be taken by the bank if you default on your loans. You don't see your children maybe as much as you should do because you work very hard. But the rewards are also there. And in particular, I think the thing is that every day is different and you can make it what you want. And I think that's the thing. You don't wait. You make your luck. And I think that's the big news. And I suppose the milestones are the first time you employ someone, it's a big, big risk. Then when you employ your second person, it's only half the risk. The third person's only a third of the risk. So by the time you employ 10 people, it's not such a big deal. And the engineering business that came out of clients we met in other fields, other engineering fields that we were training on. And today, really, that's high end engineering, particularly for the food and beverage industry. And again, we go for blue chip clients. household names. And what we're looking for there is really the robotic end and the highly mechanized end in what is a very specialist environment. It's typically hyper hygienic. We call it anaerobic, so you'd have to be operating in a highly hygienic situation at very, very high tolerances with a lot of backup and service and training that goes with that as well. So that's the other business.
All right. Ian, so what's your position in both these businesses now? Is it still the same when you started, or have you sort of taken a step back in one, or more focused in the other? Or?
That's a good one. I did plan to step back from the training business and spend more time on the engineering side. I managed to do that for a year or two. However, that really didn't work out. So I've really now in both businesses. It's about 60-40, I would say. It is a problem when you found something yourself that it's so much of your DNA is in it. I do have succession plans in place. I have sold shares to key employees. I do have a plan. And I'm trying to put that plan into action now, but it's difficult because it's part of who you are. It's part of there's an emotional side to it as well as just a purely transactional side, and I think that's maybe part of the appeal. So there are plans afoot. It isn't easy to do. It's not an easy thing to withdraw from a business when you've been part of it for so long, and it's not easy for the people who need to take over. You need time, you need to give them the power to make some changes, and it's another journey, but we'll do it. We're what we call process consultants. We don't know the answer when we start, but we work through a process and we normally get to an answer, and that's what I'm doing with that as well. That's the plan anyway.
Okay. Right.
Good stuff. Good answer.
So maybe just go back a little bit to the early day. Well, the early career, I would say, after post-university, what you did. And did anything during that time, sort of set you up, I suppose, for starting a business? Because it probably does take a certain amount of courage or certain, mindset to jump and take the risk, do that. And how do you convince yourself that, to take that risk, that it's the right thing to do?
Yeah, I think a lot of that is nurture as well. My family are farmers, so as a result, they were used to maybe standing on their own two feet a bit. So I think that comes from at the cradle. You're not expecting to have somebody come along and tell you to do something, and then of course with that comes that responsibility. I think it's very difficult. It would have been difficult for me. I wasn't able to leave education with able to start a business. I was really fortunate that I got into a global market leading company when I left university. And that company invested heavily in my training. And I really would say that's the secret. When you go for a job, just to follow the money is not a good idea. Go for somebody who's going to develop you, somebody who's going to train you, somebody who's going to give you the opportunity. And, that business did a lot for me. It not only showed me the world. I don't know how much it cost them in terms of my development. They put me through an MBA, for example. So, that then gave me the confidence to actually say, okay, I can do this. Mm. Now it's about making that jump, which my wife would say I always wanted to do. It was always there that, I was always going to have to do this. So maybe that's something that's in a lot of people. But, a lot of people dream about doing it. But dreaming doesn't get you very far. You've got to actually sit down and make a plan. You've got to lay it out and think to yourself, right, what are the pluses, what are the minuses, and go in with your eyes fully open and expect some knocks and expect a little bit of a hard time, but and it's not for everyone. It's not for everyone. Yeah. But equally, I look at a lot of my corporate clients and I think, well, I couldn't do what you do. I like the fact when I get in my car and shut the door, I leave all their politics behind. That's their problem then,
Yeah. How long were you in the global company for before you made the jump?
It was 7 years. So there's just 7 year itch. So I was 28 when we started BFM. Right. And, you know, it was seems a long time ago. I'm 60 this year. So, you know, it's a.
That was about the time I was born, wasn't it?
It was, actually. Mm. You were born when I was still at, if we dare mention it, Massey Ferguson. You were born when I was still working there. But I think within 5 months, I'd made the jumps. I think if you were born in the August, I think I resigned on Christmas Eve or something. So there you go. But equally, it's really important to keep the relationship there. I resigned on Christmas Eve, but I was back working with them as an independent. You know, I think on the 6th of January. So don't burn your bridges either.
it's a small world, Dean. Always comes back and bites you.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well. Yeah. So what's it? 1985. So how many? Economic crises have you, as the business experience since then?
There's really been, I would say, three major ones. The first one was under the John Major government. There was a man called Norman Lamont, who was the Chancellor. And the British decided to go into the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, known as the ERM. We tagged, and I think this is a big theme for me. I always look at currencies. Currencies tell you so much. We tagged our currency at too high a level. The idea was that there was going to be some sort of currency union, and really that we all ought to be working towards the euro. And I would say, for egotistical purposes, I can't think of any other reason that John Major and Norman Lamont decided to put the pound in it to a higher level. It was a perfect storm for somebody to short the currency, and they did. Mm. And I remember driving home one afternoon when, in desperation, the fools in Downing Street put the interest rate up to 30%, 33.0. They did it for an afternoon in desperation, absolute desperation, to stop the pound falling. And of course, they failed. That led to a massive run on the London Stock Exchange. And when we went back to work, the phone started to ring, and it was cancellation after cancellation after cancellation. And it really was heartbreaking. If we had been in business for even 6 months less than we had been, I think we wouldn't be having this conversation today. I'd have been on a different career path. But we just had enough factor on ourselves to survive. And the way the business survived is that basically I went and worked in the United States. I just got myself a lot of clients in the US. And I was typically spending 6 months of the year working in the US. And that's how we managed to keep the business going. So for 18 months, it was what you might call export driven. But it certainly worked, because the UK economy was really hit the buffers. So that's how we survived that one. I'd also say, because we have a niche strategy, you know, we don't try and work for everyone. That's also good, because you get to know your clients a lot better. So people who know their customers are always going to be more successful than those who try to have a scattergun approach. So that was the first one. Mm-hmm. After that debacle, things started to get a little better slowly. And then really, I suppose, and I don't think it's anything to do with the man himself, but I think history probably will say that when Blair came to power in 97 with Cool Britannia and everything else, we did hit an incredibly, it was almost like recessions were a thing of the past. Gordon Brown said they were. but it really was. It was year on year of sustained growth. And, if you look at our figures, at the end of that decade, we'd grown by tenfold. Yeah, so that was fantastic times. And of course, then we had the subprime mortgage. We had the whole thing of derivatives. We had the masters of the universe, who clearly weren't even masters of their backyards, dealing in financial derivatives that they didn't understand, didn't know what they were. We had villains. I don't know if I can say it, but like Fred the Shred, we saw the Bradford and Bingley go. We had to see massive state intervention in the banks. And to be fair, although history will be kind to him, but maybe people still in this country aren't. Gordon Brown, for everything he may have been as a leader, did exactly the right thing. He took a Keynesian view. He stuffed a lot of money into the economy. He really came up with a QE idea. And the big thing he did, he got global reaction. He pulled everyone into London. He said, look, we've got to do this. And even countries which are, you know, really weary about such things like Germany went along with it. And, you know, for right or wrong, it certainly managed to bring the economy back into some sort of semblance. But again, you know, it took a long time to recover from that. A lot of cancel orders. You know, our business went backwards during that time. And I wouldn't say we fully recovered until 2011, 2012. But even so, that's a lot better than what happened, for example, in Europe. Our Spanish division lost money all the way through 2008, right the way through to 2015. So, you know, it was hard, really, really hard.
What did you do like to react to it?
Basically, I called everyone in and said, look, as long as we break even here, I'll be happy. Everybody's got a job. Just break even. And I think that once you take that threat away from people, I think that they feel, OK, I've got a chance now. Yeah. And we literally redoubled our effort in terms of making sure we had a very good relationship with clients. We were producing what clients wanted, and that was enough, really. It was that plus, I guess, the fact we had a bit of brand behind us by then was enough. But also, I would say that because we have chosen the industries we work in, I've managed to keep away from the typical economic cycle. You know, if you take, for example, agriculture completely avoided the recession of the economic crisis. In fact, if you take a very crude indicator, but that would be tractor registrations, they hardened during that financial crisis, and they've stayed better than they were in the 10 years before. So it's also about your segment. It's about who you're working with. I think that's important. The right economic segment will behave differently. They don't all behave the same. And if you can find a contracyclical segment to work in, that's always going to be good. Or not even contracyclical, but one with its own cycle.
Yes, it's like spreading your risk like you would in the stock market or something.
Exactly the same idea, you know, and looking for where they are. And agriculture, certainly, people always need to eat. And even this crisis is going to show up the importance of agriculture and distribution, I would suggest, like trucks and trucking. You know, I think it's going to, and warehousing, it's going to be a big deal. And then, of course, we've hit this one. You couldn't see this one coming. I mean, I know that there were scenarios that said that there's a possibility, but when it came, it was still a major shock. And yeah. We called everyone in and said, we've got enough money in the balance sheet. I've always built a strong balance sheet. We've got enough money to pay you all for 2 years. Your jobs are safe while you're with us. And then, lo and behold, you know, there are some grants available from the government. And so all that means that we're working our way through as we did last time. We're finding new products and services to offer customers. On the engineering side, what we're finding is that we are now being asked to do more emergency repairs. We picked up a job yesterday, a big job for a major dairy. Would supply 60% of the whole milk in the UK, and normally they'd have brought across a German company to fix this machine, but because of the travel situation, they've asked us to do it. So, you know, it's an ill wind that blows nobody any good, and certainly on the training side, unbelievably, we have actually managed already to invoice for 3 or 4 jobs. It's nowhere near where we should be. We had a fantastic start to the year, but it shows you what you can do.
Yeah,
you know.
I think it's good sometimes to get like a bit of a wake up call as well. I sort of liken it to driving. You get a bit complacent sometimes, and you might have hopefully it's a minor bump that you might have, but it wakes you up to, you know, to what you know, to pay more attention, and you sort of realise that, you know, you've gone on autopilot a little bit, and you should really be focusing a bit more on the, what you're trying to achieve. And it's, I guess it's a similar thing with this, isn't it? I mean, obviously, I know a little bit because I'm still involved a little bit with what's going on, and everyone has reacted, haven't they, and rallied in a very different way. People were saying they've not felt more connected to each other now for quite a while when we're all in the office together. It's sort of a healthy thing as well, I think, isn't it?
I agree. I think you can carry on doing the same old. You can sleepwalk along. But a good example would be, I think a lot of people will say after this, how much travel do we really do need? Mm. You know, do I need to go into the office for that meeting? Yeah, I think there's going to be, there are new ways, new ideas. And I think, you know, it's always good to reinvent. It's always good to change, you know.
Yeah. It sounds like you've treated your staff very well over the years, Ian. I mean, my opinion is that, you know, people make businesses. So if you look after your people, you know, the business gets looked after in the long term.
Yeah.
And you look at some of the businesses that have just dumped their whole staff, you know, somebody like Wetherspoons, for instance. I wonder what the repercussions will be for Wetherspoons after we come out of this this situation. You know, talking about boycotting and things like that. I don't know.
And people do. I mean, you might remember the Ratner story. Where he stood up and said, what we sell in the shops is crap, and he thought it was a joke. And within 10 days, they'd gone bust, and they had a shop in nearly every high street. People do remember. And I think it's not going to be to the betterment of some of our alleged entrepreneurs like Mr. Branson and co. You know, I think there will be a kickback. And people don't believe what they hear. They believe what they see. And, you know, every HR department says people are our greatest assets. And then they turn around and treat them awfully, you know. So I'm a great believer in not so much saying things, but actually getting on and doing it, and to go into writing to people and say, your job is safe for 2 years. But the thing is, I don't want to lose anyone. There is no business without them.
Yeah.
Certainly not a business that I want anyway. So I think it will have an impact on some, and equally, what would it do if you were a potential employee of one of those companies? You take the job because you had to. Would you go the extra mile? I doubt it, you know, and then you end up like another.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, before we just talk about your investing history, because I know you do have you do invest in the stock market, I wanted to get your opinion really on the economy in general. You know, do you think this situation is setting us up for something terrible? Do you think it'll be over quite quickly? You mentioned Gordon Brown with all the quantitative easing thing. Do you think all the free money that's been printed now, is that something to be worried about or not yet? I know that I'm a doom monger when it comes to currencies, but I think I'm in a minority on that opinion.
Right. Okay. I think that, we do have different views on fiat currencies and gold standards and things like that. I think we do. But I did say earlier that I always watch the currencies. If you look at how QE was actually paid for by the UK government, what they've actually done is made us all take a haircut. You can dress it up as you like, and none of the politicians will agree to it. But you only need to see what's happened to the exchange rate. You know, how the pound has devalued against the US dollar and the euro since the economic crisis. And by doing that, what you can do without borrowing money is you can just basically make your currency worth less. Mm-hmm. That's the thing to look at now. How will the markets react to the value of sterling? That's the one to really, really to be concerned about, because that's going to tell you an awful lot about their monetary policy and whether or not that's actually worked. While people are happy to buy dollars and run to dollars, the Americans will get away with it. Wonder though, when people talk in terms of trillions, you start to wonder whether actually will that continue. That's the thing. So my view on this present one is it's a huge shock. It's already caused a lot of bankruptcies. It's there are a lot of people who, regardless of what the government would like to say, through desperation, will actually start to go back to work anyway. Yeah. And I've anecdotally, I can tell you I'm seeing that anyway. So the big corps are still pretty much on lockdown. And the issue is actually now that the many people who are selling the equipment in particular are now saying they can't get the equipment because the factories are shut down. The factories, even if they're open, are relying on supply chains, which are very stretched. So, for example, there's a Japanese manufacturer we work with that has an operation in France, and it turns out that 20% of their componentry comes from Italy. And that's not even the Far East, you know, that's from Italy, that's within the European Union. They cannot get it. If you take the biggest tractor plant in Britain, all its drivetrain comes from Milan. And Turin, it's you know, they're not getting it. So that we're actually heading for a shortage in some key capital equipment products, trucks, tractors, and to a lesser extent diggers. And you're not getting them because literally the supply chain, and that's on something that's fairly still, I'd say European. Imagine the situation if you're then working on, I don't know, starter motor windings which come from China. There's going to be a real sort of, it's not easy. Just can't re-kick these supply chains. And if you can, do you want the same ones as you had before? That's another big question, I think, for many people. And this is a virus we're fighting. If it was a physical war with guns and tanks, if you can't make the steel, if you haven't got a merchant navy, you all of a sudden you realize you're very exposed. So I think that there's going to be a rethink, I think. And it's not going to be straightforward. It really is going to be a very much a piecemeal approach. But that also does allow for some opportunities as well.
So you think a slow recovery then?
This is a severe shock. This is a major shock. And we're talking GDP going down by double digits. This is going to require a lot of fiscal policy. And it's going to require some joined up thinking. So I think that we'll see sectoral glimmers of hope, but equally in the race to the bottom parts, I'm not happy at all. I think there's going to be some severe problems. Okay. And I think it's what the economists would call discretionary spend. That's where your problem's going to be. So I might go back to the cinema, but I probably won't have that pizza before. It's going to be that type of thing.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. So you're not a gold bug, are you? You're not rushing to the nearest bullion supplier.
I've always had a disregard for gold. You can see in times of crisis, it's got its use. But what I don't like about gold is that it doesn't actually work. It's not like a factory. It isn't like a company that produces something. It just sits in a cupboard somewhere. That's my reason I don't like gold.
Fair enough. Okay. Shall we spend the last 5 minutes just talking about your investing history then? I think it's probably a good time to wrap up on that. When did you start? When did you start investing? What did you go for? Why? Your attitude to risk, and if it's changed over the years, and what you think might be a good, opportunity now, a good buy in these times.
Okay. So I think, like a lot of British people my age, typically you didn't really get involved in investing. But there were such golden opportunities given to you under Thatcher. that you were mad if you didn't buy British Gas or British Telecom, or you were nuts. So I think, like a lot of people, we piled in there with our £200 or £300 or whatever it was. That gave us a sort of taste for it. Then the demutualization, the Bradford and Bingleys, for example, of this world, as that happened, you sort of said, I'll have a bit of that as well. Mm. And then really, I guess the thing that sort of made it is the ease, particularly of online trading platforms. And I use two. I use Interactor Investor and I use AJ Bell. I think they're both, I would say, reasonably fair in terms of fees. And it enables me to have, I would say there are three real sort of portfolios I keep. One is a SIP, which is, of course, more conservative, maybe. Then there's a straightforward trading account, and I have as much as I can put in an ISA account. And I'd say my attitude to risk is I'm not risk averse, put it that way. I'm quite happy with risk. I find the alternative investment market a lot of fun. But in terms of how it changes, you've got to accept that the swings can be hellish. It can be absolutely hellish. If you don't like that sort of thing, then stick with United Utilities or Centrica or whatever, which hardly move at all, regardless what goes on. Mm. Before Christmas, I decided that with the Santa boom or the Boris Banks or whatever stupid word you want to call it, I thought the British Stock Exchange had peaked, and I got rid of 80% of all my equities. So that's about $250,000 I turned back into cash. If I'd have kept it for another week or two, I think I'd have done a bit better. I'd have probably done 5% better anyway. But I still had the courage of my convictions. And then I sat on the cash until this crisis hit, and then I've waded back in.
And it's good timing.
Maybe. But again, if I'd have waited 2 weeks longer at Christmas and maybe 2 weeks longer in March, I think I'd been even better. So I've had some very, very, very lucky ones. I'm looking at some of the results here. So Genus PLC. I bought $10,000 worth of that, and they're up by 44% today. GlaxoSmithKline, they're up. Biotech, they're up 22.2% since I bought in March. AstraZeneca up 10.75% since when I bought them. All those sort of biotech businesses, doing very nicely, thank you. But equally, I've got some lemons. I really like Next. I liked its trading strategy. I like the fact that it almost cooperated with its competitors. Mm. So in other words, Next Brands, you could buy, Superdry through Next. They didn't try to compete. They actually let them be in the catalogue. I like that approach. So I sold them at a nice profit before Christmas. I bought them back again. I'm looking at a 36% loss. Generally speaking, I've done better than just sort of letting it sit there. That's the thing. I've got some funds, Indian funds, Russian funds. I think the Russian economy's got some legs. I did until this came along. Of course, because of being in Britain, I guess I'm overexposed to miners, particularly in AIM. I've got some dodgy mining companies, I'd say, in my portfolio.
That's probably my fault.
Your fault. Yeah, I mean,
still think they'll come good.
Some aren't doing too bad. ECR, for example, ECR Minerals. When you consider everything's happened, I'm only down 13% on them. But Metal Tiger, I'm down 47% on Metal Tiger. I'd hate to know what I'm down on some of these others. I mean, it's just like, but there you go. And equally, you've got some that hardly moved, United Utilities, for example, hardly moved at all. So, So okay. It's great to have the sort of hindsight of it. At the minute, I would be looking for more in biotech, anything to do with robotics, anything to do with getting that can replace menial human labour, particularly in agriculture. It's quite clear we're having to fly in, migrant workers to pick cabbages. Mm. So, looking for machinery manufacturers that are at the forefront of that. That's got to be good. Robots in agriculture, robotic spraying of crops, robotic milking of cows, all of those things are definitely high up my agenda.
Okay. And do you have any rules that you apply to yourself in terms of diversifying or not particularly, just go for what you feel at the time?
I used to go for what I felt at the time. Now I don't, because what I found is that I was collecting too many. Yeah. I woke up one morning to see I had shares in all UK supermarkets, and I thought to myself, that's a bit foolish, and also at one stage I had four or five bank shares, so now I only have two bank shares. I have two UK supermarkets, two utility companies. I wouldn't say it's a hard and fast rule, but and as I said earlier, I feel I'm a little bit overexposed to miners, but I think that's just the British Stock Exchange is a bit that way itself. So, but I do think understanding the different sectors is important. I think it's also don't invest in a company you don't understand. You're being like those people that were selling derivatives. Make sure you know what the business is actually doing. Mm. that's good. See who the people are running it. What's their track record? People really do make such a huge difference. They'd be my first two. If those two are in place, then typically the results follow. I don't mind if it's a capital gain or if it's a dividend. I think maybe in the next couple of years, it's going to be the capital that's going to become more important than the dividend. We've already seen some companies having to knock the dividend on the head, like the insurance companies and the banks. So maybe that side isn't going to be as fluid as it was.
Okay, good. That's good. Kenny, did you have anything to...
Listen, I was just quite happy to sit and listen. It was one of these podcasts where I'm taking it all in. So I'm almost like a listener rather than a participant. I'm quite happy.
Good.
Okay, good. Yeah, all right then. Well, thank you for coming on. I hope you enjoyed it. I did, and Kenny did as well. Hopefully our listeners do. So thank you for your time.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much for the invite.
Okay. Thanks, Ian.
Cheers. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Next time on the podcast, we'll be talking to Mark O'Byrne. I hope I've said his name right there. And he is from Goldcore, who are a Boolean trading exchange company with an online trading platform. And we'll be talking to him about gold, silver, and all the precious metals, really, and getting his take on the situation and why he thinks gold should be a part of everyone's portfolio. Tune in next time.